Welcome to the AOT Pod, an all-new FRCS-themed podcast tackling key themes, challenging topics, and insightful intellect within otolaryngology. Hosted by myself, Georgie Wellstead, and my co-host Joshua Michaels, with the support from the ENT UK Foundation and the Association of Otolaryngologists in Training. Your guide to passing the ENT FRCS starts here, as we take you around the country speaking to some of the best and brightest minds our specialty has to offer. So without further ado, let's begin.
Okay, so thank you to Georgie and Josh. Welcome to our listeners. I'm Shivan Kosler. I'm an ST8 registrar here in Kent, Sussex Deanery, and I'm the current AOT FRCS representative. It's my real pleasure today to introduce one of my bosses, Mr. Karan Kapoor, who's a consultant head and neck surgeon at East Surrey Hospital and founder and operator in chief of the annual Redhill FRCS course. Mr. Kapoor, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for that very kind introduction. The course is actually run by not just me, but quite a few people. So I'm the chief emailer in to get people there.
Well, that's perfect. So everyone will be emailing you to ensure that you can they can secure their spot on your course. Now, before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty of today's topic, which is the management of multinodular goiter, especially focusing on goiters with retrosternal extension, I've got a couple of questions for you. So, I mean, you've seen a lot of registrars come through your Bible course before the second part of the exam, or sometimes even before they've done the first part of the exam. If you had to identify one specific piece of advice that you could apply to almost all candidates, what would that be?
I think the piece of advice, having run the course for a number of years now, would probably be to believe in yourself. I think a lot of people don't realize that this is a conversation and you're supposed to really feel that you're the equal of the person that you're talking to. You're at the same level. Try not to think of this as your boss or someone that you're trying to impress, but someone you're having a conversation with. And also sometimes just admitting, sorry, I don't quite understand the question. Can you repeat it in another way for me? It's those normal things that you try and do. The more that you believe in yourself, the more that the person in front of you will believe in you. And you'll be surprised that most of the time you probably know more than the person who's sitting in front of you. I certainly learn a lot, especially when it comes to rhinology, otology and peds, if I ever have to do one of those vivas.
Perfect. Well, hopefully today's conversation is going to be exactly that in the manner of an FRCS, very informal chat about a multinodular goiter. So another question for you. Can you tell me about a case you've got that's coming up that you find is either interesting or you're excited about?
I think the cases that I get excited about personally are the ones where they're multidisciplinary, either working with Max Fax colleagues or working with oculoplastic colleagues. You know, I think that's where the enjoyment is for me now. But I think on a routine list, the thing that I really enjoy is that period of sort of 6 to 12 months where you get a registrar who finds a certain part of head neck surgery challenging. And week by week, you kind of see them improve and grasp concepts. And often they don't even realize they're doing it. And then suddenly they will look back and go, God, I never used to be able to get the superior pole, but now I've got the superior pole of the thyroid. And I'm also, you know, starting to understand how to find, the recurrent laryngeal nerve. Those sort of things, I think, are things I really look forward to.
Yeah, no, I fully understand. I've sort of come to a similar conclusion as I've come through my training as well, and found that as you progress through a training job anyway, for sure, regardless of which subspecialty that's in. Mm. Now, this one's a little bit off-piece, this question. Mm. I've been having a discussion with this about with a couple of my friends, actually. So if you were asked by a veterinarian to put a tracheostomy onto a giraffe, whereabouts on the neck would you want to put it?
So the one thing I know about giraffes is they have a very interesting trachea. So their trachea, if you think about that amount of dead space, physiologically, the lungs, which sit within the thorax, which is outside the neck of the giraffe, it would be too great for them to be able to pass that amount of air up and down. And so what actually happens is that the trachea, rather than just being a C shape, they're actually sort of interlocked so that the whole of the trachea narrows as they're breathing to change the actual volume of the trachea. So they've got a quite interesting trachea. So I would be thinking that you've got to understand why you're putting the tracheostomy in, I think would be my first question. Is it due to an obstruction? And therefore, if it's just due to a simple obstruction, like in, I'm guessing, like within horses, where they get sort of a, they might be obligate nasal breathers, that if that is the reason that it's nasal congestion, then just putting it just below their phonatory cords would be, it would be the same principle that you do there. But I think for maintenance, I'd want to put it lower because otherwise I'd need a ladder every time I had to change the tracheostomy or suction it.
Yeah, that's exactly my thinking. I think I'd put it low, basically just to make it easier for the keepers to manage, to be honest. So, well, thank you for that. Who knew you knew so much about giraffe anatomy? But that's very interesting. Now let's move on to the focus of today's talk anyway. So we're going to talk about, as I said, multinodular goiter, and then with a focus on retrosternal extension. So, when I'm in clinic, I get this question quite a lot from patients. So, how would you explain what a multinodular goiter is to a patient?
What's a multinodular goiter? Well, that's a really interesting question. I think we all understand the idea of a nodule, and people understand that as a swelling. And they often usually also associate that with a benign, i.e., non-cancerous issue, which I think's easy for people to sort of get their head around. And when I explain to people that nodules within the thyroid are very, very common, and if we look at a population, 50% of women over the age of 50 will have a thyroid swelling, will have a nodule in their thyroid. And a lot of this is thought to be due to the effect of estrogen. And so people then start to appreciate that. And when I talk to them about, have they ever had a member of their family with a sort of slightly swollen throat, they recognize that idea. And that's literally what goiter means. It actually comes from a French word, and the Latin, I think, is gutter, which is another word for throat, which is basically a benign swelling of the thyroid. When I was doing some reading about for this podcast, I actually noted that there were goitrogens, which are foods which can actually increase the chance of you having a goiter. And this isn't cake and chocolate, but strangely enough, it's actually things like the good things in life, like broccoli and kale and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts. So all these cruciferous vegetables actually can affect the processing of iodine, which can increase the likelihood or inhibit processing of iodine, which can actually increase the risk of having a goiter or a swelling of your thyroid. And if we were to go back 200 years or in certain parts of the world, not in the UK, obviously, because we now have iodinated foods and water, but back in sort of 200 years ago, Derbyshire was an area known for having low iodine. So this would therefore create that environment where you haven't got the iodine, your thyroid then swells up. And that's what causes a goiter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that fact about 50% of females having a nodule over the age of 50, I think in our population and seeing our patients, I think they find that really valuable as a reassuring statement. And certainly, particularly as these progress and increase with age and we don't understand them, I think sometimes explaining to patients that we don't understand certain things, I think can be challenging, but also I think it's reassuring to them in some ways.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. They often realize that they've got a friend who's been in a similar position, and they feel reassured that theirs is likely to be reassuring. If you're already diagnosed with a multinodular goiter, you've probably done some workup beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Well, let's get on to our clinical scenario for the episode then. So this is going to focus on the retrosternal goiter. So this is I think, a very typical presentation. In fact, I saw two patients today with this. So a 65-year-old female with a long-standing history of multinodular goiter is referred to your clinic from primary care because of increasing size and symptoms.
Okay.
How would you go about assessing this patient?
So it's a long-standing multinodular goiter. I mean, GPs usually give you a whole plethora of things which are on a PDF nowadays, at least in my hospital on the EPR. And so you sort of like search through there to look for a set of blood results to see, are they euthyroid? And the majority of these patients are going to be euthyroid, i.e., they're not hyper or hypothyroid. You'd look and see if there's any imaging already on your system. If they're a patient who's well known, you might have an old ultrasound or old scan, which has kind of highlighted this before. I think, with everyone, what do? I mean, Shiv, you and I are very similar probably in clinic, where we'll probably both take a history of exactly what's been going on, this increase in swallowing, difficulty in swallowing, and this fullness in the neck, how long has it been going on? And there are associated symptoms, particularly, heat intolerance or feeling cold all the time, weight change, hair change, these sort of things which are pointing us to subtleties. If we don't have a set of blood tests, to see is this person hyper or hypothyroid, and then be also looking at things like the sort of autoimmune type histories, the history of the rheumatoid or joint conditions, trying to see, what are the underlying causes. I think that's where I'd start with a good history on the patient. It's also important to be thinking about, those slight risk factors as well. And when it comes to thyroid, exposure to radiation, certain jobs might increase your chance of being exposed to radiation, such as a radiographer. Thinking back, geographically, Chernobyl, back in, I think it was, you're gonna have to remind me, Shiv, was that 89, 88?
Past. I don't know what year Chernobyl was. I
I
definitely
think it was
wasn't
80.
alive then.
Apologies, I was that. I think it was
I didn't watch the
88.
Sky TV show on it either, so I
Yeah.
can't give you that.
But yeah, but there, so that is a risk factor for Eastern Europe. But what was really amazing then was actually Poland. Poland did a phenomenal thing. They gave iodine to virtually 90% of their population, reducing the risk of thyroid. But sort of Eastern Europe, people who grew up in the late 80s, that's certainly something which you'd be thinking of as a potential risk factor. Other things, sudden increase in size. That's a concern, but often that goes with sort of a hemorrhagic picture where you've got a nodule that's bled into it. Hoarseness is a really big one for me. People often say, "Oh yeah, I'm a bit hoarse, or my voice has changed." Now, you've got to be aware that hypothyroidism can change your voice, but it's more that sudden, more acute, sudden change in voice, which makes me think about the recurrent laryngeal nerve. I think those are sort of the main things that I'd be thinking of when taking my history off the patient.
Yeah, of course, and obviously, past medical history is obviously included social history and medications, because obviously it
Oh yeah,
might
no, I think
make a
you're quite right.
difference in.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, sort of that's more a holistic approach, and it's very important to be thinking about that. But I think in the exam, it's really important to kind of focus in on the thyroid focus thing. You're quite right. For the real world, you're very much thinking about things like who's going to bring them to the hospital, how do they get there and back, and whether people are dependent upon them as well.
Yeah, of course. Now, when you so you've done your history, you've taken a full history on pertinent to the thyroid and pertinent to the symptoms that that patient is having. What are you looking for clinically when you go on to examine the patient?
I mean, there are some obvious things. You're looking at how they're dressed. Hypothyroid patients are a hypothyroid person's usually got a jumper on in the middle of summer, and the hyperthyroid patient is wearing a bikini in the Christmas holidays. I mean, I'm joking, but there's an idea of those are sort of things that I'm looking at. But then you kind of just look at your patient, their body habitus. It's amazing how many really big thyroids are hidden within the neck, and you don't really notice them at first glance, but you've got to have a careful look at the neck, the width of the neck, the length of the neck. If you're someone like me, I've got like a very short neck compared to you. You've got a nice long, elongated neck. Yeah, obviously not giraffe-like, so I wouldn't have to worry about where I
No.
placed your tracheostomy. But not that you'd ever need one.
Fingers
But
crossed.
exactly. But you're looking at sort of like that. What is the size of the neck? If it's a short neck, sometimes even something which isn't that large can be a more challenging thyroid, because it's kind of hidden within that area. So you're looking at their body habitus, you're looking at if it's obvious from the end of the bed. There could be simple things like that Pemberton, when they're sort of they look slightly plethoric anyway, they've got these kind of full vessels, but they can't lift their arms up, because otherwise they tend to tend to collapse a little bit. But that's that sort of compression of the venous outflow. So those are sort of subtle things you're looking at. You're also listening to their voice, hearing if there's any added sounds. Is it raspy? Is there any stridor at rest? Thyroids don't usually do that because it's a soft, smooth swelling, which is doesn't you still maintain a non-stridulous voice. But if there is frank tracheal invasion, you can often get a change in voice, which is phenomenally rare. But these are things that you're sort of those subtle things that you might be picking up on before you even touch your patient.
Yeah, these are the one percenters that really kind of set the alarm bells ringing, aren't they? And anything else, particularly when you're feeling the thyroid gland itself?
So, I mean, I feel that the neck in the same way every time I start. Literally, even if they've got a thyroid swelling, I'll start under the chin, I'll work my way along level one, up to the jugular digastric region, the top of level 2B, work my way down the SCM to level 2, 3, 4, and then I would go to feel the thyroid. And if it's a particularly large thyroid, you kind of notice it quite early. You can feel that fullness. And I'll always literally hold one side and palpate the other of the thyroid, and then hold the other side and palpate the contralateral side. And then there's that whole thing about swallowing. And I think what I find really interesting is most people don't understand why they're feeling the neck when you ask the person to swallow. And my reason, I don't know what your reasons are, but please tell me if you think differently. I'm trying to see what is the inferior extent of a thyroid. I'm not trying to see, oh, it moves with swallowing. I mean, I kind of already know in the front of the neck, that area, you know what a thyroid feels like when you've been doing it repeatedly. But I'm trying to get my fingers between the clavicle and the end of the thyroid, because as the larynx moves upwards and the trachea moves upwards on swallowing, it because it's fixed at the point of the isthmus, it's going to lift up. And as it lifts up, I want to know, do my fingers get underneath it, between it and the clavicle, to know, is there a significant retrosternal extension? Because if I can't get my fingers between it, then I'm thinking automatically, oh, maybe there is a element of retrosternal extension on this thyroid. And that will then educate me as to how I want to investigate this person further.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I do, and I also get them to extend their neck as much as is physically possible. One, to see intraoperatively if you're going to operate on them, how much neck extension is useful to help plan and understand your operation, how difficult it might be. But then secondly, to see if you can exactly feel the caudal border of the thyroid to see if it comes up into the neck or stays behind the clavicles.
I love that. See, this is those are the sort of words that you just used there, which really help that caudal border. You know, when you say that in an FRCS or that, someone really knows. Oh, look, this guy really knows, or this girl really knows what they're talking about. I said the inferior extent, but it's those little subtleties. They're sort of drop signs of somebody who's, understanding of the anatomy, the nomenclature. It's really good.
I'm very fortunate to be on the other side of the exam, so I'll only be using those nice little phrases for a short period more, I'm sure. Right, so perfect. So you've gone through this patient, you've examined them, and then you've gone retrospectively with the patient, looking through the radiology, whether that's locally or peripherally, that's been transferred in, looking at their bloods and everything else. So clinically, this thyroid is going behind the clavicle, and you can't feel the bottom of it. So what? How would you assess, say this is a completely new patient, slightly different scenario, what would you want as a minimum set of investigations?
So I think for me, if there is that retrosternal extent, what well, like every thyroid needs an ultrasound. Every thyroid for me needs a needle biopsy, which is an FNA 99% of the time, unless the radiologist or radiographer who's seeing it feels that this might be lymphoma, because then you need a core biopsy so that you can do some of the immunohistochemistry on it. But if we look at it, 99.9% of the time, you're getting an FNA because this is a vascular structure, and core biopsies do tend to bleed a little bit more. I want to know whether they're on any anticoagulants before I send them off to my radiologist for that ultrasound guided biopsy, and we'll send that off. If there's a retrosternal extension, I'm very keen on a CT. In fact, I will always request a CT. And then there's this big discussion whether it's with contrast or without contrast. I'll always get it with contrast. And there's this whole thing of, oh, but that might delay radioiodine treatment later on and so forth. Honestly, the period between you getting your CT, getting through an MDT, operating and then needing radioiodine is long enough that I don't think it makes a difference. And if you've got significant retrosternal extension, understanding the anatomy with a good appreciation of the great vessels, I think is really helpful, because then you can really delineate where this virus is. Is it in the anterior mediastinum? Is it in the posterior mediastinum? You know, you're not, I think you just get a better set of imaging and you feel more confident. And I've never known it to impact radioiodine in terms of management. And equally, there are times where we've not been able to get radioiodine across into the UK because our suppliers are in Europe. And people have been waiting for 3 or 4 or 5 or even 6 months without a concern about the impact. And remember, that's only for people who've got malignancy, and that malignant rate within a multinodular goiter without overtly suspicious signs, you know, is quite low, where you're going to need to use radioiodine rapidly.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would request mine with contrast as well. I really want to know what the relationship is to the innominate, where it is in relation to the aortic arch, pulmonary, and pulmonary veins as well. And even if you've got the ones that are big and going around the back of the esophagus, knowing where the crotted is in relation to them, the IJV can sometimes be useful as well. So yeah,
Yeah, I mean,
absolutely, I agree.
I had a really interesting patient recently who came in with a swallowing issue, and it had actually had a previous thyroidectomy, and strangely had the right subclavian running behind the trachea and behind his esophagus, and it was, you know, one of those really strange things. He'd already had thyroid surgery, so you know those things do happen. They might be really rare, but you know. Again, we're talking about 1% here. We want to be better informed. And people always think about the non-recurrent laryngeal nerve. Well, that sort of anatomical variation on that right side is the reason why you want to know, because then if they do have any aberrant anatomy in a large thing like that, if you've got aberrant anatomy, you might have a non-recurrent nerve in that area. And in a really large multinodular goiter, that might even be make it easier.
Very true. I mean, those undiagnosed vascular ring patients are quite rare, though.
Yeah.
So you'd be fortunate to see one. Now, talking a little bit about, so you get a cross-sectional imaging, which I agree with. Now, there's slightly controversial. Now, I know opinions differ on this topic about the large compressive goiters with people with true symptoms of dysphagia or exertional dyspnea. What do you think about barium swallows and flow volume loops?
I'll tell you what I do, which is the people who present with a multinodular goiter, I'm not going to be getting a barium swallow on them, and I'm not really going to be getting a flow volume loop. I think a flow volume loop is academic, realistically, in my opinion. It doesn't impact what we're doing surgically. I think that and the barium swallow doesn't really impact what we're doing surgically either, because if it's an incidental finding, then it's very different. If someone comes to me and I can't really feel very much in the neck, and sometimes you don't, and they've got a bit of globus, and I've worked out they haven't got any red flags, I might get a barium swallow then. But it's not really when I've found a large multinodular goiter, because to me, that anatomical size and the cross-sectional imaging there will be the thing which really impacts whether or not you know, we're thinking of surgery. If there's a little bit of indentation on a barium swallow, how I can't see it really changing my management plan. I don't know. I'd love to hear the opposite view on that.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think from a lot of the people who I've spoken to, consensus really is using it if you suspect something else really is the cause and it's not the goiter, whether it's presented, it's incidentally found on cross-sectional imaging, say the patient's gone to A&E and they sent you or you made a referral to your SHO that there is a patient with compressive multinodular goiter. I have seen people use it in the patient post-operatively with ongoing respiratory problems to investigate whether they've got secondary trachea malacia from a really large compressive goiter, but I think that's rare. I think in terms of indication for it.
And I think those sort of patients, I'm talking to my respiratory colleagues, and I'm saying, they're in a better position to understand that. I know there are some excellent surgeons out there. I mean, Professor Reza Narai is very big on flow volume loops and uses it a lot for sort of subglottic stenosis and things. In my hands, I think I've got a very superficial understanding of them, and I'd probably want to work in collaboration with a respiratory colleague.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think for any FRCS candidate, I think understanding the limitations of them is probably worthwhile, but routine use, I think, is probably limited to certain subpopulations based on experience and MDT work. And I think that's probably the ultimate answer for that one. But I think it's worth knowing about,
Yeah,
certainly
absolutely.
from an exam perspective. So we go back to this patient then. So clinical examinations is in keeping with a slowly progressive diffusely enlarged multinodular goiter. You're not able to feel the bottom of it, as I mentioned before, despite maximally extending their neck. Main complaints are dysphagia and an uncomfortable pressure, particularly when they're lying flat at night. And the ultrasound has come back as multiple U2 nodules, none of which have been FNA'd because the radiologist was happy that there's no concerning symptoms or signs within them. You've got your cross-sectional imaging, which is concordant with a retrosternal extension, and it shows both lobes have extension into the mediastinum, with the left side being much larger than the right-hand side. So if this patient was first presentation with no previous documentation, what would you normally do in terms of, would you sit, wait and rescan, or would you, based on that symptomatology, would you want to maybe offer something?
I think this is where talking to your patients are really important. You've got to understand what their motivation is. They said they can't lie flat. They find it really uncomfortable. And you've got a cause for this, which is your large multinodular goiter. Now it's bigger on the left. We know that the thyroid there can cause those symptoms, and you can get that feeling of compression against the clavicle, pushing up when they're swallowing, affecting swallow. So if they're symptomatic, I would be talking to them about the fact that our monitoring is just telling us the rate of growth. And yes, you can wait for 9 to 12 months or 12 to 18 months even to rescan them. But what am I waiting for? Am I waiting for those symptoms to worsen? Am I waiting for it to get to a certain point and then I operate? Well, actually, no. For me, it's the symptoms which, if I believe that the imaging concurs with symptoms, I would then be offering surgery in my hands because I only believe that this is going to grow with time. One, either gravitationally, or two, by the fact that nodules do tend to grow over time if we look at them in that longitudinal aspect. The reason that I would say maybe to pause would be if there are significant comorbidities, and I'd be saying to the person that actually, look, you're not really that fit for surgery, and do we really want to put you through something like this? Or if they were unsure, if their symptoms are very mild, and I don't think it's concordant, or their expectations are maybe not in keeping with what I think surgery can offer.
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree with that. I think many people would say that you've got a patient who's symptomatic. Clinically, you can feel a large thyroid, and radiologically, you've got evidence of a large multinodular goiter. I think, yes, you could wait and rescan. And I think in some patients who maybe are not symptomatic, you may consider doing so. But I think in a symptomatic patient, I think you're just delaying what ultimately some people might say you might be delaying the inevitable, because you're going to have to operate eventually. And what are you going to do? You're going to wait until it either gets harder or gets to a place where you'll need something else that we'll come to later on in the podcast anyway, when we're talking about. To say you're going to take this patient, you decided to offer them surgery, okay? When you're going through their cross-sectional imaging, what are you specifically looking for to determine? Obviously, you work mainly in the DGH. Obviously, you have a malignant head and neck specialty practice as well. But say if you're just doing this in a DGH hospital, what would you be looking at to see whether this would be safe for you to do and your team, including the whole team around you, your anesthetic colleagues and your intensivists, should they be required? What would they be able to manage?
So We're talking about a large mountain goiter without any other suspicious features, but it's big. And I'm thinking about the realistically, it's the inferior aspect of this. And I'm looking about the mediastinal component of it. Now, when I think of the mediastinum, I'm not just thinking of distal extent, but I'm also thinking about whether it's in the anterior mediastinum or the posterior mediastinum. So most studies suggest that thyroids, which are in the anterior mediastinum, have their blood supply from the normal areas, which is the inferior thyroid artery. They don't tend to pick up vasculature from the anterior mediastinum. It sort of just falls into that area. And on the left, it's going to fall to a certain extent, but it's then bounded by my
So,
arch aorta and the brachiocephalic as it comes in that area. It doesn't tend to go into the posterior mediastinum very much on the left side. That's not that it can't, but it doesn't. And it's usually limited in that area. And I'm really thinking about that arch of aorta and thinking how far below the arch of the aorta does it go? I think there's a paper by Professor Neil Tolley and Charlie Huens, if I'm not wrong, could be somebody else, but that's just memory. Look that up yourself. So don't just go on my word on that one. But they had a look at the distal extent of the anterior mediastinal thyroids. And if it's going beyond the arch of the aorta, significant, that's an area that you've got to be thinking, can you safely get out? Can you get your finger literally that far down in order to gently tease this out? I'm also, I mean, sometimes these tend to be more conical shaped when they go down that way. But also, if it's dumbbell shaped, is the distal aspect of this thyroid wider than the thoracic inlet? So it's all very well getting down there and getting be able to get out, but you've got a fixed opening to bring it out of it cervically. And because we don't have cardiothoracic backup locally, I'm really going to be thinking, can I physically bring that up and out? When I'm thinking about the posterior mediastinum, there are those which fall back into the posterior mediastinum, and they are technically more challenging. And often they present much larger, much later because they don't cause the same symptoms. You've got a lot more, not dead space, but you've got a lot more space for it to grow into. And they do compress the lung parenchyma, and they can pick up more neovascularization from that area. So they can be tend to be slightly more challenging. They can also cross over more. So when they're sitting in that posterior mediastinum, they tend to be presented a little bit later, tend to be a little bit larger. And I think that's where I would be very thoughtful about whether this needs to be sent to a tertiary center with the support of cardiothoracics, where they can either do a sternal split for the anterior mediastinal thyroids, but actually it's more a thoracotomy, and it's usually a right-sided thoracotomy for the posterior mediastinal thyroids, which can tend to slip down into that area. And we were talking earlier about the watchful waiting. I remember a case that I did when I was at Guy's Hospital with Rickard Seemo, who is a phenomenal, fantastic thyroid surgeon. I think certainly one of my mentors and the person I still phone up every so often to get advice from. There was a lady who came to clinic to me. She was just touching 80, and we were talking about exactly this, a retrosternal thyroid, which was causing her a little bit of shortness of breath, and the CT showed this really large posterior mediastinal tubercle hanging down, pressing on the pleura on the right side, compressing the lung a little bit. And I said, "Oh, did you know about this?" Because, "Oh yeah, I've known about it for quite some time." I said, "Oh, how long?" Because, "Well, when I was getting married in my late 20s, I was told I had a multinodular goiter. And I thought, well, I didn't want to have a scar on my neck at that point. And then I had kids, and then I had, childcare issues, and I didn't really notice it. And it's only started to really affect me now." And she was touching 80. So there is a discussion about watchful waiting, but we did have to do a right thoracotomy with the support of our thoracic team. And so I think those sort of cases are the ones which you've got to be thinking. And if you're unsure, and especially if you're starting off in your career, there is no harm in phoning a colleague and saying, "Look, I'm not sure about this one. Would you mind taking this on, getting a senior colleague to get a second opinion on those the imaging? Being humble is a really, really strong characteristic in a surgeon, because there is no such thing as a brave surgeon. It's the patients who are brave. They're the ones who are really taking the risk, putting their life in your hands, and you've got to know where you feel comfortable. Do you feel that this is right? And sending it up to a tertiary centre. And in the first few years, I went up to Charing Cross and to Guy's, to do cases there, the ones which were, I felt, on the edge of my ability, to know actually where is that limit, where is that line? Because it's clinical experience, it's time, and sometimes you can be wrong as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's not just for the FRCS, but I think just for anyone's general practice. I think those are very important points that I think most people will take forward. I think just digressing back slightly towards the retrosternal goiter specifically, I know that Rickard Simoes talks about a few other things that he notes when he's looking at these retrosternal goiters, particularly the calcification pattern, because
Yes.
hard calcified nodules are much harder to remove transcervically, and then that the classic the iceberg type retrosternal goiters, the ones that don't really present in the neck, that are usually only ever incidentally picked up either on the chest X-ray or as a mediastinal mass or a or on a cross-sectional image. He says those are ones that are quite ones to be aware of, particularly as new consultants in starting your practice.
I think you're really right. I think often what we do is we're compressing the thyroid a little bit manually with our hand when we're trying to bring it out. And you're absolutely right. And Rickard's team has got possibly the biggest, the largest experience in the UK, at least, of these retrosternals. And not being able to compress that with that calcification can make it really challenging. You're right. Absolutely.
Perfect. So, moving on to malignant potential within retrosternal goiters, what is that, and can you accurately determine that from either an ultrasound staging or an ultrasound-guided biopsy?
So, I mean, in the UK, we've got the U classification system. I think internationally, people use the TI-RAD system, and you're looking at the nodules you can see. Now, an ultrasound's not very good in the retrosternal region. So, you're only really assessing anything, clavicular and above. So, then you're going on your CT imaging. And if there's nothing overtly concerning there, and your ultrasound has been reassuring, then you're not thinking this is a malignant lesion. However, when you look at the population data on this, and when you look at the incidental or occult malignant findings in it, I think it runs somewhere, I think 20 or 25%. Yeah, for T1, so the C1As, which are incidental findings. And again, the larger your thyroid, the bigger your thyroid, the more challenging. If you've got 4 or 5, 2, 3, 4 centimeter nodules in there, you might not pick up that tiny little nodule, which is slightly more suspicious, because literally, it's like a sampling error. It's the same thing where the larger your thyroid, when you're taking a needle biopsy, once you get over 4 centimeters, there is a sampling error rate as well.
So, in this patient, when would you think about performing a total thyroidectomy up front versus just a hemithyroidectomy with a view to going back to do the other side?
I think in retrosternal thyroids, who present symptomatically, I'm predominantly thinking of a hemithyroidectomy initially, or hemithyroid isthmus, because usually one side is bigger than the other. And if you've got this really large retrosternal thyroid and you remove the bigger side, suddenly you've decompressed this area quite significantly. And so, where you've got compression, you've now got decompression, and therefore symptoms usually improve quite significantly. Equally, you're only then exposing one nerve to risk, and you're also reducing the risk of hypocalcemia. So, I think that's my default position of suggesting that unless there are overt malignant signs or this person has a history of thyrotoxicosis. If they're in a hyperthyroid state and they've got an autoimmune condition there, maybe at that point, if an endocrinologist said to me, "Look, we're finding it really difficult to manage them. I mean, literally 3 weeks ago, I had this very same scenario with a retrosternal, it was retrosternal thyroid, not massive, but a guy with a short neck, a retrosternal element, and he was poorly controlled on carbimazole and propranolol. And then I did the total thyroidectomy up front. Did the bigger side first and then did the smaller side afterward. But I think my default position is trying to convince a patient that the hemithyroid is better. But you've got to also realize that if you go back and say you're going to do the second side as a stage procedure, they never feel the benefit of the second side as much as the first because we've already had that decompression.
Okay, I fully understand. I think, yeah, it's very patient specific, isn't it? You've got to choose your patient, their comorbidities, and try to individualize the risk. Particularly, you don't want to subjugate them to a bilateral nerve palsy, even if we know your nerve monitor's working, but they still wake up with a nerve palsy. So, and obviously hypocalcemia.
Yeah, but I think that's a really good point, Chev. You're right that even if the nerve, if you're concerned about the nerve and you've said to someone you're going to do a total, if you're really concerned, there's no harm in pausing and doing it as a stage procedure. But you're right, just because it stimulates at the end doesn't mean that it is going to be working perfectly. We've all had those cases where we're really sure of the nerve and they wake up for a hemithyroidectomy and they wake up a little bit hoarse. It will improve because we know that it's intact, but that can be a few weeks down the line.
Great. Now, so going with it, exactly what we said. So we know that this is ultimately all U2. We're going to do the left side only because it's the larger side, the one that you think both clinically and radiologically is most contributing to that patient's symptoms. So you've seen the cross-section imaging. What strategies surgically do you use to optimize your access?
Okay, so I'm not somebody who operates through small incisions. And I think that what you want is good visualization, good mobilization, and therefore an incision which is generous enough to give you access. So, it'll regularly be an 8 centimeter incision based on that midline. And if it needs to go wider, I'll go wider. The first thing I do is I go down the straps right down, and it's really important to go all the way down to your manubrium. So divide the straps all the way to the manubrium and up to the tip of the thyroid notch or the thyroid cartilage notch, because I think what you then get is you get good exposure. And then there are sort of interclavicular ligaments just between the heads of the clavicle, which kind of hold a little bit of the thyroid in and dividing that. So you're compressing with usually I'm with my index finger on my non-dominant hand, and then I'll divide all of those interclavicular ligaments. And that was something that Rickard taught me and said, look, you then suddenly get this area where mobilization of that retrosternal area is really quite helpful. If it's significantly big enough, I've seen it, I think dividing your strap muscles early. So not just going down the midline in that linear alba and separating them, but actually making sort of dividing. I use a harmonic or a ligature or any of those sort of devices. You can do it with a monopolar, but then at the junction of the upper two thirds and the bottom third of the strap, I'll go across it with the idea at the end of this procedure, I can then reconstruct those muscles. And why? Because you get better exposure laterally. You can then mobilize things a little bit more. And then, as I said, going all the way up to the sort of thyroid notch of the thyroid cartilage, in order to then be able to come and get that superior pole, and I'll start off on the superior pole. I'll get control there, see if I can find the external branch of the laryngeal nerve coming across there as it crosses over. I don't specifically look for it, is the honest truth. If I see it, I see it, but I'm making my division on the superior pole quite high because in a really significant retrosternal, often you can't rotate the thyroid out as easily. So often what we'll do is, obviously I'll put a finger sweep and try and see, can I rotate it? But if it's really quite large and also on the right side than the left, I might even look to identify the recurrent laryngeal nerve from the superior end. So once I've taken that superior pole, the vessel's there. I'm almost peeling the thyroid down inferiorly and laterally to find the nerve from above at cricothyroid. Does that make sense?
I've seen people use that technique where they find it just under the tubercle of Zucker candor and find it from medial to lateral at its insertion into the joint. I know
Yeah,
something.
and the reason is because normally, and this isn't what I normally do, normally I'm looking to go superior pole, go around, find the middle thyroid, and then pass my finger in and mobilize and lift everything up. But in those really large cases, this then gives me understanding of where the nerve is. And every so often, it's actually sandwiched between that tubercle of Zucker candle. It almost wraps around. And I've seen a couple, and these are rare, but it's that fact that you are always influenced by the more challenging cases you've done, where it was the tubercle of Zucker candle, which was huge, and going down into the mediastinum. So you even get those where the actual thyroid's small, but it's all there almost posteriorly. So those are the sort of techniques I'm thinking. But one thing that can also help is to split the isthmus early, so you get more movement. So you're not sort of stuck on the trachea, and you can mobilize one side probably quite a little bit more easily.
I think those things are important. So just to summarize those, so wide exposure, splitting the isthmus early, muscle splitting incisions, other powered devices are available. We're not sponsored by any brand on this on the AOT podcast. And what other things I've seen is some people splitting the layer between sternohyoid and sternothyroid to raise a flap more easily to give more space. I've seen that done. Not necessarily using a Joel's retractor. Some people use that quite as a routine, but considering using either silks or fish hooks to improve your access to get tension in the right directions could be useful. And
Oh,
even
that's a
using
very,
fish
very good
hooks
idea.
laterally as well. And the other things I've seen, making sure that you don't sever the bridge between the cervical and the thoracic component, I think, because sometimes you shimmy the thoracic component up by maintaining that connection, however tenuous that small might just be a one nodule on a tiny pedicle, but making sure you don't come through that or inadvertently disrupt it with a finger dissection or blunt dissection. I think those are the things I've seen. So now we talk about, so these cases that are more challenging or non-routine, we talk about preparation being really important. Now, say with the state of things now, sometimes there's a significant interval between you seeing a patient and them having their cross-sectional imaging and then you actually operating on them. Now, what would you do with the unexpected increase in size compared to your preoperative imaging if you'd already gone ahead and started an operation? So say you couldn't get that retrosternal component out. What goes through your mind in those stages?
I think you've got to be humble. You've got to realize that are you doing the patient justice by continuing? Do you think that you've got to sort of pause? I'd often say to people, take your gloves off for a second and just pause and just go through what you've done. Have you done everything you could do? Have you gone through that isthmus? Have you gone down to the manubrium? Have you released all of the ligaments in that area, which will help mobilization? Have you found the nerve? What are the things that you could maximize, the exposure and so forth? But if you're struggling, there is always the option to call a colleague. And even in a district general, I may not be able to have a colleague come in and help out who may be the head next surgeon. Most places will have at least one more person, but you can speak to them on the phone. You can phone up one of your old bosses. I've done that in the middle of the night when I was starting out, definitely, because sometimes it's just some advice and it helps you see the wood from the trees. If you really can't get it out, I think you should always stop, take some images, and close up, and then send it to a colleague who could do it. But while you're in there, what are the things that I've noticed that can help? One thing that I've done probably three times in my career, and twice was during my fellowship with the consultant who taught me this, was taking a micro debrider intracapsulally, so into the thyroid, in order to decompress some of the retrosternal component. And then that allowed us to compress the thyroid a little bit more to get our fingers around it to be able to bring it up and out. I'm not sure if that's something which many people do, but I've done it once as a consultant, but twice as a fellow. And that's sort of 15 years of experience and only having to do that twice. I'd always say just pause and stop, and you can always. And I genuinely have been in that position. I remember the case vividly. It had been discussed at the MDT. It was actually a malignant case. It was a medullary thyroid carcinoma, and I'd done one side, I'd done both necks, but I'd called one of my colleagues. He was actually junior to me. He was a consultant, but then been a consultant for less time than I'd been a consultant. But I called him because it's sometimes good to just have somebody else to talk things through with. Actually called two of my old bosses who gave me advice. But the inferior, that caudal aspect of the thyroid, I could feel the arch of the aorta, and I wasn't sure whether I could just sweep my finger in, but because it was a malignant case, I was worried about neovascularization. And I thought, if this bleeds here, I've got no control. And then I just have to pack it and have to send them this person as a emergency to a tertiary center. So I put a long stitch in the thoracic component of this. I'd taken out the rest of the thyroid. I'd done the necks, and I phoned up one of my old bosses and said, "Look, would you mind taking this to theatre?" And he said, "Actually, not a problem." 2 weeks later, took the patient to theatre, and much to everyone's amusement who'll be listening here, he did it all cervically, but he had thoracics available, so that if when he put that finger sweep on the aorta, there was a vessel, they would be able to control it. But it was able to be done all cervically. But at the end of the day, the patient got the best result. Yes, I wasn't the surgeon who completed the surgery, but my ego isn't that important. What's really important is that your patient knows that you're putting them at the center of care and not your ego.
I think that's the best summarizing fact for the entire FRCS fiber examination anyway, making sure you put in the patient first. And I mean, having been through the exam, there are difficult questions in the fiber stations that push you at consultant level thinking and where you've made a mistake. And I think that having that introspection is important. But going back to that, I've heard of people doing that where they've either aspirated nodules in the mediastinum to reduce the burden, and then sending off the aspirate to make sure there wasn't malignancy in those nodules, just to try and reduce the bulk and try and move it out as well. But yeah, and then other things I've heard, I know this is up to a discretion, and it's very individual, but doing the cervical component completely, so they don't have to necessarily go back into that side on the neck to reduce the risk to the parathyroid and the nerve, and then allowing them to just do a purely extra cervical approach if they need to for the mediastinal component as well. I've heard that. I don't know if there's good evidence either way for that, to be honest. I think that's
I
just an
think this is the
option.
whole point, that if you are going to do that, if you are amputating it because you can't take something out, I think that's very reasonable. But I would definitely put a
Stitch.
stitch, sort of like a Prolene or something on the superior aspect of the area that you weren't able to excise, so that somebody knows if they are going thoracically or they are going even cervically where to begin and where you've ended. And it's really helpful to take a couple of photos. You'll always be able to get a stack system in there. You can get a 0 degree. You can take some photos to orientate people to where things are. Simple things like, I mean, this isn't so much for the thyroid, but this is more recurrent thyroid surgery. What I will do is I'll get the radiologist, when they're ultrasounding the neck, to tell me how many centimeters below the end of the thyroid cartilage or below the end of the cricoid the lesion is. It sounds silly. You're marking the neck when you get someone to put a sort of a dot on the skin. Well, it really depends how much they're extended, doesn't it? But knowing in centimeters how far away from a fixed point, such as your thyroid cartilage or your cricocartilage, something is, can kind of help you where it is. So taking a measurement from that area, putting it in the note saying this is the distal extent of it, can be helpful. I know there are a lot of surgeons now who are developing ultrasound skills. maybe your generation of surgeons will be much better at than I still rely on a radiologist for that sort of thing. But intraoperatively, if there's a fixed point that you can measure something from and say, look, this is where it was, I was finding it difficult, it will just help the next person, or even you if you have to come back.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kapoor, for your time in talking to us today about multinodular goiter with a focus on retrosternal extension. Many tips and tricks along the way, both for people who are listening to this specifically for the FRCS exam, but also anyone else listening just to improve their general practice cases. So thank you very much.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. Well, look, I just want to say a little thing. I need to say thank you to a number of people. If anyone's still listening, Tony Jacob, David Mitchell, Ricard Simo, and JP Janon, when it comes to thyroid surgery, they really got me from being a blithering wreck to someone who can just about hold their own with a thyroid. So, all of us learn from many people, and I think those great names and great surgeons were people who've really influenced me. So hopefully you'll all learn and be even better than I am.
Well, thank you very much. So to summarize what we've talked about today, so when talking to patients about a multinodular goiter, we find it useful to tell them that, particularly in the female cohort, that 50% of females over the age of 50 have a thyroid nodule, and we don't actually understand the cause of it, but there are a number of things termed goitrogens that may contribute to the development and progression of a multinodular goiter. When assessing a patient with multinodular goiter, especially if you're concerned about retrosternal extension, taking a full history with pertinent features of malignancy and also focusing on symptoms of compression, which include swallowing difficulty and breathing difficulty, as well as taking into account patient features, pressure, pain, and cosmetic factors are useful. When examining the thyroid, you really want to assess where the trachea is, what the chorda border is doing, and is it in the neck or is it beyond the clavicles when the neck is maximally extended? And what is the patient's posture like? Have they got good neck extension or have they indeed got cervical lordosis? Does it move on swallowing or is it fixed? And checking for any lymphadenopathy and voice change is important as well. From an investigation perspective, baseline thyroid function, including autoantibodies, are essential. As well as ultrasound scoring of it and cross-sectional imaging with a CT neck and chest is most typical, and we decided that that with contrast is probably more beneficial than that without. Flow volume loops and barium swallows are useful to look at other causes of potential symptoms, but not necessarily essential for the assessment and treatment of patients with multinodular goiters with compressive symptoms. When talking about surgery, we're looking at the extent of the retrosternal goiter, whether it's into the anterior or posterior medius sinum, as that can dictate what you need to do, the shape and size of the goiter, and whether it's beyond the aortic arch or not, and the classic calcification and iceberg shapes that are very difficult to manage just transcervically. We're also looking at the size of the thoracic in the context of the mediastinal component as well. Retrosternal goiters have an assessment of malignant potential of about 25%, although the majority of those will be T1a papillary tumors. When would you do a total versus a hemi? Well, in autoimmune thyroiditis would be a case, but it really is a patient-by-patient assessment. And obviously, in malignant cases, you should try to do a total thyroidectomy upfront, whether or not that's transcervically or with an extracervical approach as well. Techniques that you can use intraoperatively to improve your access include wide exposure, splitting the muscles if you need to, mobilization and getting into the right plane, and dividing the isthmus and intercavicular ligaments. But there are other strategies as discussed before. And in challenging cases, don't be scared to phone a friend.
Thank you for listening, and we hope that you enjoyed this episode of the AOT Pod. Be sure to check out our other topics and give us a like and subscribe to get notified when new episodes become available. For more educational resources, visit the AOT website, aotent.org, and our YouTube channel, AOTENT Education. See you next time.